and the pension funds, the mechanics of who's going to hold, carry the stuff. Platinum's even better than gold then, by the same standard, and
yeah.
And what we want is to hold that store of value, and maybe gold isn't going to be from today. Now, last year it was different. From today to next year, how do we know that gold is the best store of value?
It is the best store of value. There are several differences. One of the main differences is that gold, silver, and platinum are important industrial metals. They are consumed. Mm-hmm. And platinum, for instance, 95% of the platinum that's produced is consumed. Gold is not an important industrial metal. Almost all the gold that has ever been produced from the beginning of time is there, and still here in the world today, in stocks. Some of it is in jewelry and in teeth and so on, but most of it is just in stock. Been coined, or it sits in bullion form in the vaults of central banks. Central banks around the world, for instance, hold almost half of all the gold in the world, and they hold no silver. In other words, the currencies of the world have been backed by gold and not by silver, at least in the 20th century. Ever since William Jennings Bryan, you know.
So what you're saying, though, is that you made an original point that the importance of gold was because of its intrinsic value. But I think what you're also making a point is that in addition to that intrinsic value, there's a tradition, a long-standing tradition, which has to do with people's faith in different kinds of things. And that you're saying is throughout history, people had more faith in gold and have historically gone into gold whenever there's been trouble, and that tradition is still very strong. Is that
right? Yeah. To put it in a nutshell, I am not sitting here telling you what I necessarily think is best. You know, I'm not trying to foist something on you. I am only telling you what the marketplace has decided over the centuries. That's my observation of the marketplace. And the marketplace has gone much more for gold as a store of value than it has ever gone for silver.
But your first statement was the whole system is broken down.
That's right. Because the whole system was based on gold. It was never based on silver, not the whole system. Certain currencies have been based on silver in times past, but never has the whole system been based on silver. It's always been based on gold.
I don't understand the point of your question.
Okay, I guess my point is that to go just with gold. I agree with his point about pension. You know, the pension funds ought to have a store. We ought to try to store the value. But putting all of our golden eggs in one basket, I guess, is not the way that I would do it. That I would look at diversity among several good stores of value.
Isn't that in the bill?
And that's what the bill says. And
the bill includes
silver and platinum. It doesn't include barley futures or a couple of futures.
Well, you've also recommended that too, have you not? I mean, gold.
I took early retirement from Citibank 8 years ago. And I have been a private consultant in domestic and international money. So I have clients. And I have never recommended to a client that he buy silver or platinum, except as a trading, you know, to make money by trading in the marketplace. That's all right, but not to hold it as a store of value. I've never recommended that. I've always recommended gold.
The only one you use as a store of value would be gold. So if you were to decide that you wanted to put a certain chunk of money into a store of value, you would put it all in gold.
I would put it into gold. If I ever became a consultant to this fund, that's what I would do. But, you know, there are many, many ways to make money. There are even other good stores of value in the world. There's art. There are antiques, stamps, and so on.
Well,
but all I'm saying is that gold is the supreme, and And I would tell you here in Alaska, why bother with anything that's less good? The gold is going to better be the best of all over the long run. So I...
it's been recommended to us by other consultants that we take our money and purchase oil in the ground as a store of value.
Yes.
Mike Gravel, I think, is
for a country, this gentleman over here asked me whether you should sell your oil for gold. I think that is a good idea. But I would also, I think holding oil in the, buying oil in the ground is a good idea. Yes. In other words, in this presentation, I cannot possibly go into all the ramifications of it. I'm trying to make the main point.
Will you finish with the
explanation? Now, may I finish? Now, yes. Now, I was at the point where I said market forces always, at certain times, drive short-term interest rates above long. This happened in this particular squeeze in September 78. And I measure it by the commercial paper rate of interest rising above the rate of interest on AAA corporate bonds. They're a short-term instrument issued by AAA companies and a long-term instrument issued by AAA companies. Short rate went above long in September 78. Now, if the Federal, I'm coming back to your point, if the Federal Reserve had not tried to resist that, we would already have had a recession by this time. But the Federal Reserve resisted it by continuing to pump money into the system, by continuing to buy U.S. government securities and create reserves for the banks. In so doing. And Miller was chairman of the Federal Reserve Board at that time. Well, he got into real trouble, especially the dollar got very weak in October of 1978. And on November 1st, we had the famous Carter program when they increased the discount rate to 9.5%, and they doubled the gold auction. And they marshaled $30 billion of foreign borrowings to defend the dollar. You remember all that program. And for a time, the dollar got strong. And interest rates went up. Prime rate went up to 10.5%, as I recall. But then Miller kept pumping. And as he kept pumping, the banks continued to use these reserves and to make loans, and interest rates peaked and they began to come down a little bit. But then the system began, the dollar began to get into more trouble. And Miller left for the Treasury and then brought in Paul Volcker last August, and by October 6th, Volcker had to have the dollar was so weak that Volcker had to have an unprecedented measure. He put the discount rate to 12% and tightened money, and interest rates went to all-time highs. Short rates were way above long. But now Volcker has lost his nerve. And so we had a second peak.
Let me ask you now, what Volcker did is that consistent with or contradictory with the underwriting that you've been talking about?
He underwrote more. He underwrote a greater expansion of credit. And so now we're in trouble. But no. When he lost his nerve.
Yeah, right. But after, the thing that was highly touted as Volckerism or whatever.
That's right.
That was a reversal.
A good measure.
That was a reversal. Right?
That's what I would have done, yes, if I'd been in there. Yes, that was good, but then he lost his nerve, and he began to pump reserves into the system again, and now interest rates are going up again. And we are now, Mr. Chairman, I think, in the worst liquidity squeeze or liquidity crunch that the world, that this country doesn't know, that the world is ever known. I think our interest rates now are going to go to such high levels that we will have failures of a lot of these illiquid debtors that you mentioned before. We'll have failures of savings and loans and savings banks and commercial banks. The worst, the most vulnerable part of the whole system, as I see it, the whole dollar system, is the euro-dollar market, where that market has now grown to about $1 trillion. And there are many foreign banks in the market. They have no access to the Federal Reserve. They are foreign. They have no access to the Federal Reserve. There's no deposit insurance in that market. And yet they have borrowed short and lent long, particularly to these third world countries around all over the world, like Peru, Turkey, and Brazil. There's an article on Brazil in today's Wall Street Journal, if you haven't read it. And these people are going to get into trouble. A lot of them are going to get into trouble and won't be able to pay. And this is going to cause this debt pyramid that I have in mind to start to, it will slow down its expansion and even begin to contract. And this is why I think we're going into a very severe depression. The rate of inflation, I don't agree with Morgan Guaranty that the rate of inflation will go to these levels. I think now that unemployment is going to rise and commodity prices will pretty soon start to tumble. The rate of inflation will begin to abate, and we will be into a very severe depression probably this year, before the end of this year. It will continue. I think it's going to be a depression on the order of the Great Depression. And it will be a very severe debt contraction. The dollar, a time will come, I think, maybe a year or two away, when the dollar will actually begin to gain in value. In other words, we will have deflation. You, Mr. Freeman, will be able to go into the supermarket and buy more groceries with the dollar, not fewer. And let me just say, to wind this up, even in such circumstances, gold will continue to be a better store of value than dollars. Because in such circumstances, you will a lot of dollar debtors will be unable to pay. There will be defaults on bonds, for instance, and maybe defaults on some of my CDs, or my certificates of deposit, and so on. And I just remind you that in the Great Depression, when banks, we lost 10,000 of our 25,000 banks in the Great Depression. And when they first began to go in 1930, let's say, people characteristically went into, took their money out of weak banks and put it into strong. Then as more banks failed, they became frightened of all banks, and they began to take Federal Reserve notes out of banks. I can see some nodding heads here. Some people remember this. They began to take Federal Reserve notes. And but then in September 1931, the British went off gold, and the price of gold shot up in sterling. And in the spring of 1932, more banks failed than at any other time in the Great Depression. And in that period, people were not satisfied with Federal Reserve notes. They took gold. In fact, it was because they took so much gold out of the banks. I've already told you that anybody in those days could go in and write a $100 check and get gold. They took so much gold that Roosevelt, when he decided to raise the price of gold, said, I'm going to fix all those SOBs who took gold out of the banks. I'm going to take away their windfall profits. So he nationalized gold and made everybody turn in his gold at $20.67 an ounce. And I have a letter in my file from the U.S. Treasury. I was very curious to know how much was turned in. And the letter tells me very clearly, gives all of the value of all the gold minted from the beginning of our history, and I found that 35% was turned in. 65% of the people refused to turn in their gold, in spite of the fact that there were very heavy penalties. But the point, the real point of this is that gold, we commonly think of gold as being a good store of value hedge in an inflation, when paper money is losing its value rapidly all over the world. But it is also a better store of value than paper, even in deflation. As all of these people who took gold out of the banks in 1932 found out.
I think the gentleman just answered my question, but I'll go ahead and ask it anyway. If, as I understand it, the reason the price of gold is high is because they weigh it against paper dollars, right? And if they have to lose faith in paper dollars, gold becomes more valuable. And in our whole history, I mean, we've had our ups and downs, you know, disasters, inflation, deflation, crash, and so forth. It doesn't seem logical to me, based on past history, that we're going to be continually, from forevermore until the big bang, going to have inflation. It seems reasonable to me to expect that there's a possibility that the government is sooner or later going to wise up to all these problems that you've related to, and start doing something that will restore confidence in the dollar. And as the confidence restored to the dollar, the value of gold goes down. Now, what happens from a practice, aside from the long range theory? I some of it I understand, but I still think it's too late for that. You disagree? What happens from a practical political standpoint if we go ahead and do what is being suggested here, and Mr. Bushry goes out and puts millions of dollars into gold at, say, $800 an ounce, and in 3 years from now it's worth $67 an ounce, or $100 an ounce, or $200 an ounce? What do you think is going to happen to those people here who did this kind of a thing through the employee pension plan along with Mr. Bushry?
It'd be a disaster. What I'm telling you is that in my observation of the market, what you have just postulated is not going to happen. That the flight, it's contrary to all reason, because paper, people now know that paper is not a good store of value. More and more people are knowing that. I mean, the newspapers every day are filled with opportunities to buy gold and why you should buy gold and so on. And so that more and more people all around the world, mind you, because this is not just a dollar problem, it's all over the world, are becoming gold-minded. So the prospect, in my view, is just the opposite of what you have projected, and that is that this thing is going to get a lot worse and not better. And I do not have the confidence in the people in Washington. I've been down there, and I do not have the confidence that you seem to have that our people will wise up one of these days, you know, in government, and make the dollar a sound currency. In my view, it's going to be market forces that will bring this about. And I've already given you my greatest hope of going back to gold, and that is after this depression that I foresee coming, when a lot of the illiquid debtors in the system have been wiped out, and the Federal Reserve, I haven't said this, but the Federal Reserve will be in a position of pushing on a string. I don't know whether that phrase is familiar. They will, Mr. Chairman, the Fed will make the reserves available to the banks, but there will be so little confidence on the part of the banks and their customers and so on, and there'll be so few credit-worthy borrowers around that the banks won't use those reserves. And this is what happened, if any of you remember, in the 30s, we had huge excess reserves. the Federal Reserve was then pushing on a string. And I think that for a time, we are going to get into that that position again. I don't think it'll be as long as it was in the 30s, because I'm afraid this time that we're going to have bigger and bigger budget deficits, you know, and more defense spending, so on. So that I think the real danger comes from a resumption of more inflation after.
Will the depression?
But I'm now looking, trying to look too far ahead. I can't see that far. I cannot.
Will the depression occur more rapidly if states invest huge amounts in gold?
Yeah.
But then,
yes.
And if that does occur more rapidly, would it be more severe or less severe than if it occurs?
The sooner, that is a very good question. The sooner the printing presses stop, the better. And anything that is done to make the printing presses stop, in my view, is going to make the situation better. Let me compare in the 20s, we had one simple boom and then a bust. In the 60s and 70s, we have had four of these liquidity squeezes. And the first time that short-term interest rates went above long was 66. The second time was 1969-70, when Penn Central failed. The third time was 73-74, when Franklin National Bank failed. And now this is the fourth time. And if only they had allowed market forces to take hold, you know, and give us a depression or a recession that would squeeze out all the illiquid debtors. If they had done that in the 60s, we'd all be better off today. But each time the Federal Reserve got the thing rolling again, so that today, this squeeze is by all odds the worst we've ever had and will do the most damage. You see, that 66 squeeze only gave us a mini recession in 67. The 69 squeeze gave us a full-fledged recession in 70 and 71. The 73-74 squeeze gave us the worst depression we've had since the Great Depression. And this one is going to be still worse. In other words, this thing is getting worse from cycle to cycle.
Let me ask you a couple of questions there. I think anything that the pension fund would invest in, let's say right now what are we investing in? Mortgages?
Government bonds, mortgages, bonds, corporate bonds, some kind of stock.
Corporate bonds and some stock. Now, all of those have certain risks inherent.
Oh, yeah.
It's generally seen that mortgages, are, if they're done right, are a pretty safe investment, but in a depression cycle, mortgages are going to be defaulting left and right, too, and mortgages are not very safe. Corporate bonds, obviously the same situation. Stocks even worse probably, since they're subject to other kinds of psychology besides something real, right? In terms of what happens to them. So the other things that we're investing in now have associated with them certain risks. That risk we would evaluate differently given different predictions about the future. Okay. Now I think what rightfully those of us on this committee should be concerned with, and I think Mr. Freeman's concerned with and others, is that, you know, is investing in gold gambling in the sense that the risk is very high and the rewards might be very high. Therefore, Mr. Freeman's analogy that rather than run into it, we might want to walk. Or is the risk, nobody can predict the future. Where is the risk? Is it comparable with these other scenarios? And I think that's the essence of this question, isn't it? Because gold is seen, I think even the cartoons that we're seeing here, with satires about requiring license, gambling licenses for those people selling gold, because of the great fluctuations we've seen in the last month. $100 up and then $50 down, and these types of things. And it does erode confidence in what's going to happen and that it is taking risk. I know my father, for instance, would never go for it. He absolutely thinks it's incredibly risky thing to do. I wonder if you could address that question to see the essence of it.
Yes. I tell everyone who asks that question, excuse me, many people do, that the real risk is in holding paper assets. After all, I've emphasized this now two or three times already, paper got its value from gold. And it's now paper that's going down against gold. It's not gold that's going up, really. It's all paper money is going down against gold all over the world. And so anybody who holds paper is holding, he knows it. He can just see it, and he's holding a depreciating asset. And this asset loses value in terms of what it will purchase at the supermarket. It's losing value day by day. But in addition to that, you have what you just mentioned, Mr. Chairman, you have this danger of default in a liquidity crunch. The mortgages, there will be defaults on mortgages, and there will be defaults on bonds and on deposits. This is what we're going into. Now, you asked me what I meant by bailing out. The authorities will try to bail out a lot of these institutions, as they have just bailed out Chrysler. See, this is an example. Chrysler is not a financial intermediary. It's a manufacturing company. But it's an illiquid debtor. It has borrowed so much, you know, that its debt burden is just like a rock on a struggling swimmer, just pulling him down all the time. And so you lose in inflation when there aren't defaults and failures. You lose because the paper is losing value. And in deflation, when there are defaults and failures, defaults and failures that will bring deflation, you lose value because a lot of the assets that Peter holds may default. That's the problem. May I say, while I'm on this, there's another very important, I suppose, theoretical element here that I have not had a chance to introduce, and I want to put it in your mind. It's related to your question. You see, why is it that the marketplace drives out money that is not a good store of value? We've all heard of Gresham's law. Bad money drives out good money. In this case, the good money is gold. And people are taking the gold and hanging on to it. And they're using the bad money, continuing to use the bad money. But they get rid of it as a store of value. They still use it in the supermarket. But obviously, no, the problem is that if any kind of money is not a good store of value, no one wants to save it. My wife and I have just been in Turkey. And when we were there last September, the inflation rate in the Turkish lira was 80% a year. It's now gone over 100%. No one saves lira. There's no incentive to save lira in a situation like this. So what are they doing? They were getting rid of it. There were little shops all over the place. They were getting rid of it, and they were buying gold. I got back to this country, and I found out that the Turkish people were buying more gold than the American people. They're going for gold because they don't want, there's no incentive to save a money that is not serving as a good store of value.
Isn't that the case for Israel, too?
Absolutely, yeah. Israel, inflation rate's going over 100%. Yeah, Argentina, Brazil is bad. Oh, there are lots of them around the world. Now, I gave Turkey because I've been there. I've just been there. But now, the other point is that, and this is right on in Peter's up Peter's alley, if a money does not serve as a good store of value, people will not enter into long-term contracts in it. And a pension fund is really a long-term contract, especially for those who live long, you know, earn the pensions. It's a long-term contract. And this comes back to the question that my friend over there on the right asked, who I guess he's gone. But what are you trying to do? The purpose of this legislation is to save, to some extent, the value of their pension, so that when they do complete their work and they draw their pensions, they will be able to go to the supermarket and buy the groceries that they need. This business of long-term contracts affects the bond market. If this inflation goes on, our bond market is going to be destroyed. Pension funds will be destroyed if the inflation goes on, too. What you're trying to do with this legislation is save your pension funds. Believe me, if you do this in Alaska, I can just visualize other states doing it rapidly. I've already mentioned New York State has legislation in the hopper. But life insurance, there's another example. There's no life insurance in Turkish lira or Brazilian cruzeiros or Argentine pesos. People won't enter into long-term contracts like that. So you're doing. In my view, you are doing in this legislation exactly what you ought to do.
Let me ask you one more question. From what I'm hearing you say, it seems to me, in my mind, I'm visualizing this sort of world-scale economic chain letter, that, like the one we had going around Alaska here, where everyone... forget what it was, but you had to pay everybody on the list $100, and you could make, it was in Fairbanks, I know, but came to Anchorage, too. People were trying to convince me to do it, I'll go for it, but if the chain could work, as long as everyone was doing it, as long as there were new recruits to bring into it. As soon as somebody breaks the chain, then, of course, the whole thing comes down, you lose your investment and more. And it sounds to me that, like, this... I haven't really heard your whole theory about the debt pyramid that you're talking about and the illiquid debtor. But just from what I'm inferring from your conversation here, it sounds like that's what we've got here, that either the freezing of the Iranian assets, this borrowing short and lending long, something's going to happen, your prediction, to sort of break this chain, and then that's going to have, in essence, a chain reaction. It's not just going to be isolated events, but once that confidence is eroded, or once that underwriting stops, then the whole system's going to break down. That's why you're predicting this depression. Am I right on that? Or
absolutely right, yes, absolutely right. Let me just, since you've mentioned the debt limit, I can just bring that in a couple of minutes, and it makes it easier to understand the problem that we're talking about. I ask you to visualize the whole system, the whole monetary system, as an upside-down debt pyramid. Now, the pyramid I think of doesn't have a pointed top, but a flat top. So this flat-topped pyramid, when you turn it over, sits on a block of gold. And the gold is the gold in the vaults of the central banks of the world. And everything in the pyramid itself is paper. It's paper IOUs. And I put into it all the debts, all the debtors and creditors in the entire world, not just in dollars, but in all currencies. Everybody's in it. And then I array the debtors according to their liquidity. The most liquid debtors are down near the gold base. A very liquid debtor would be one that's what I keep trying to do. I want to hold only gold and have no debts. See, then I'm completely liquid. I do have a few little debts. I've got a mortgage of 5.25% that I don't want to pay off. Anyway, as you go up the pyramid and get to the top, the debtors get less and less liquid. So all the illiquid debtors that I'm talking about are up at the top. These are the ones who have borrowed short and lent long. They borrow short, but lend long, or they maybe put the money into bricks and mortar, or as New York City did, they borrowed short-term and just spent the money. you know? I mean, this, you can get illiquid in a hurry that way. Or in the euro dollar market, they borrow dollars, and then they make loans into other currencies, like cruzeiros and Argentine pesos and Turkish lira, you know, across these floating exchange rates. So bear that in mind when you read the Wall Street Journal today and read about Brazil. Bear that in mind. These euro dollar banks are illiquid debtors, and they've lent long term across these floating exchange rates that we have in the world today. So there are more illiquid debtors at the top of my pyramid than there have ever been before. Now, to pick up your point, the pyramid can go on growing only as long as you find new creditors in the system. Let me give you an example. Suppose I'm a savings and loan, and Peter gives me $100,000, and I turn he lends it to me short term, and I turn around to you, Mr. Chairman, and lend the $100,000 to you on a 30-year mortgage loan. I don't have the money. When Peter comes to me for the money, then I have got to go to somebody else. I've got to find somebody else with $100,000 to lend, who will lend $100,000 to me. And I'll have to pay him a higher interest rate so that I can pay off Peter. I call this borrowing from Peter to pay Paul. You call it a chain letter.
Well, in this case, it was borrowing from Joe to pay Peter.
Okay. Borrowing from Joe. That's right. I should have borrowing from Joe to pay Peter. Anyway, as a time comes when you can't find another Peter in the system, you know, and that's when the chain letter business breaks down. Now, and what happens is, this is what we're coming to. Then people get out. People who are down in the pyramid won't lend to those who are at the top. This is like the banks wouldn't lend any more to Chrysler, you see? Or Franco National Bank, maybe in 1974, is a better example. Other banks wouldn't lend any more to Franco National Bank. And then as Franco National Bank's CDs matured, Peter, the corporate treasurers and others who held those CDs wouldn't roll them over. So Franklin National Bank went bust. Now that, and the authorities were able to keep that as an isolated case. It didn't snowball. You know, the whole chain letter system didn't break down. They were able to keep it going.
It was $1 billion loan.
But the Federal Reserve lent $770 million to Franklin National Bank. They had less than $5 billion bank, and
it was an interesting thing, because at the same time there was a big controversy over loaning $400 million to Lockheed, and yet the Fed put over $1 billion into that bank, and it got very little publicity and very little play.
That's right. And then when the bank went broke, of course they were able. They were lucky. The authorities were lucky because they got European American banks to take over all the branches. And the good assets, there were enough good assets to keep the branches open. And so European American Bank took that over. And then the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, took all the bad assets. And the Fed lent the FDIC $700 million to carry the bad assets, which there's a lot of which they still had. But I know, you see, I'm an old Federal Reserve man, and I know how my Federal Reserve friends sweated over that one. And when I think how they're going to
sweat. That was something that might have broken the chain letter?
It might have, yeah. But I do want to say this, that, you see, I've been living with this thing all my life, really. And I did not forecast in 1974 that squeeze would be a killer squeeze. I did not forecast. I thought it could be, but I didn't forecast that it would. This time I have forecast that this one will be the killer squeeze. I don't think the authorities will be able to keep the system going this time. Keep the chain letter going. That's a good you've got a good seminar.
Other question? We didn't get into the whole question of the rating and assets and the offset that you talked about once before, but I guess
I can if you're interested.
Why don't you cover that if you can, just in
a yes, I can cover that
briefly, quickly.
You see, the price of gold has risen dramatically since the U.S. Treasury sold the Iranian assets in November. Now, lots of people think that they froze the assets because of the hostages. They didn't. And they announced so at the time. They froze the assets because Iran announced to the world that they were going to take dollars out of American banks. And instead of, I think Iran was foolish. I mean, if you're going to run on a bank, you don't say to the banker, hey, I'm going to run on you. they were stupid. And so the Treasury, once they heard that they were going to run the Treasury just early one morning, I think Carter signed the order at about 8 o'clock in the morning, they froze the assets, froze all their dollar assets, not only in American banks, not only in this country, but in American banks in the euro dollar market as well, all over the world. And froze their gold at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. That's one that you don't hear about so much, but that's one that really touched me to the quick because I used to be in charge of that gold. And as a custodian, I felt this sense of obligation to all those who were holding gold with me. I never would have frozen it. I would have resigned first. But they did it, and this shattered confidence in the whole system, because then other countries and other central banks began to say, oh boy, if our dollars are going to be frozen, we'd better get out of the dollar. And by this time, they didn't have confidence in Swiss francs and Deutsche Marks, and the yen was going tumbling down, so they didn't have confidence in yen, so they began to go for gold. And this gave this, I'm convinced that this freezing of the Iranian assets gave the gold price of quite a shot in the arm. And believe me, they are not, when they go for gold, they're not holding it at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. They're not trusting us anymore as a custodian. So this is one of the worst things that you can do. If you have, you see, we're in the position, this country is in the position of being an enormous borrower from central banks all over the world. Central banks hold about $160 billion. Of dollars. They hold it in the form of U.S. government securities, deposits in banks, CDs, some other government agency paper, and so on. And then we come along and suddenly, well, we're not going to pay you on this. That is a very great blow to confidence. And it made it worse because my old bank, Citibank, where I worked for 13 years, immediately, they were sitting in a good position because they had more deposits from Iran than they had loans to Iran. Now, a banker has the right of offset. He can always, if he has a loan, he can always offset the loan with deposits on his books. So Citibank, the very same day, offset Iran's loans, paid them off out of the deposits on their books. And then David Rockefeller at Chase did the same thing, and a lot of other banks did the same thing. But a great many banks, more banks than these few, had more loans to Iran than they had deposits. So they dared not use the right of offset.
crisis was still, you know, brand new news, and the freezing of the assets had happened relatively recently. And I'm impressed that you at that time said that you thought that historians would look back and say that was one of the key elements, and that furthermore that would cause gold in the next few months to increase greatly. And that certainly, your prediction, at least at that time, was certainly accurate, very accurate.
Thank you, Mr.
It was $350 an ounce at that time, and I went to my brother-in-law last night and said, gee, you ought to really invest in gold. This guy convinced me it might go up in the next couple of months, worth a chance. And I didn't have any money. It was $350 an ounce, not double that. So that was a couple of months ago.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions? Oh, I have one question. Who do you consider, if there is one person, to be the preeminent person in opposition to you? Somebody that you hit heads with all the time on this question? Anyone for
you? All right, let me put it. That's a good question. The leaders of the two principal schools of economic thought in our day, you know the name John Maynard Keynes. Keynes wrote in the 20s and 30s. He died in 1945, 46, I guess it was. But there have been many of his followers. His most famous follower is Paul Samuelson, who writes in Newsweek, writes a column in Newsweek. I'm not peddling Newsweek, but if you want to get the Keynesian point of view, Bob Blyberg in Barron's wrote a blast at Paul Samuelson just last week, because Paul Samuelson had said something inane. Why does gold go up? Because it goes up. Why does gold go down? Because it goes down. That's all Samuelson wrote. Now, Keynes,
I could have done that.
Keynes wrote that the gold standard was a barbarous relic. And Keynesians have not believed in the gold standard ever since. They treated our balance of payments deficits with benign neglect. The reason I became alarmed in this country was because Kennedy, President Kennedy, took the Keynesians to Washington in droves. Some of them very good friends of mine. You see, I studied economics at Harvard with Paul Samuelson, so I know him very well. And you see, I had an argument with him one day way back in the 60s, and I thought I bested him. And he said, well, John, you could be right, but you're lonely. And that gives you, I have been very lonely, although now he's getting lonely. I'm going to be able to one of these days. I'm going to be able to say that to him. But one of the basic reasons for our troubles is that a guy like a Keynesian like Paul Samuelson wrote a textbook that has been the most widely used economic textbook in the colleges and universities of the world. Is that the one you studied?
Yeah.
Well, if I may say so, you rejected a lot of it. I compliment you.
Maybe I just didn't learn it very well.
Couldn't follow.
Either way. At any rate, I've been an anti-Keynesian from way, way back. I left Harvard in 1943, and I was taught Keynesianism at Harvard, but I rapidly upchucked it. Now, more recently, there has been the school of Milton Friedman. And Milton Friedman is on my side. We both believe in free markets and laissez-faire. In fact, he's doing a series on television right now on Adam Smith and laissez-faire, and I'm all for it. But that means the government should not intervene in money. But he's got a blind spot in money. I mean, he intervenes. He wants the Federal Reserve to intervene and increase the money supply at a regular rate. Even when we have inflation at 12, 13, and 17%, as you say, he wants to go on printing money. And he doesn't believe in gold. I've debated him, and he argues that gold is just another commodity. He doesn't even put it alongside silver and platinum. He says, like copper or soybean, another commodity. Whereas I say gold is the most important money there is. He says it isn't, and he defines money as paper. So it is these two schools of thought. Another thing about Friedman is he's, for 20 years, he's advocated that the United States should sell all its gold to the market and just have the dollar back by nothing. And here I am here today telling you that the dollar gets its value from gold, see? Not the other way around. And so we have to have this gold. I've been very opposed to the Treasury auction.
Well, what you're saying is the two major streams of thought right now are both opposed to your point.
Both opposed. You could get any of them. That's it, exactly.
We've had some conversation. I've had some conversation with Walter Keller on another subject.
He's a Keynesian.
Right. He was, one time he was going to come here, but he got called away from by Carter, I guess. Couldn't make it easy to just about another subject. He would be with Samson.
That's right. He is, I would call him perhaps the number two Keynesian in the country. John Kenneth Galbraith is another, but Galbraith is not nearly as good an analyst as either Samuelson or Heller. I have to tell you what I got into an argument with Paul Samuelson one day, and he said, "John, what do you do with your money?" I said, "Well, I buy gold." This was way back about 1965, I think, 66. At least you put your money where your mouth is.
Any other questions?
One quick one. Yep. Since we're speaking to House Bill 208, which is a pension, would it be advisable to, since we are representing many people who are on pension, and they are older and tend to be more conservative, would it not be wise then to approve legislation that would adjust their retirement benefits on a percentage of cost of living like the federal does? And in that case, you would not, if you really felt secure then in investing in gold, you would take that responsibility or that fear away from the people whose money you're using and then go ahead and invest it. You wouldn't be critical, I don't think so. Criticized by those the pensioners. If we really believed in it, why not do it that way? I'll be asking the legislators that. I believe that there's legislation now and has been introduced and will probably reintroduce just such a thing. Base the pension, there is an adjustment available now, but it's not required. It's administratively may be if funds are available. However, some federal retirement is based upon, it can be up or down, but on a cost of living, and that does guarantee two loaves of bread or four loaves of bread or whatever. Now, if that would certainly satisfy the recipients of the pension fund.
That's a separate question from how to manage the fund itself.
Well, only from the standpoint that if it would tie directly to it, because I think you would have no criticism from those people. If you really have confidence in managing the fund, then it would give you liberty to manage that fund and buy gold if you want to. I think it's directly. So maybe that's just something to think about, maybe not an answer today, but I think it has a very direct relation.
I think that would be an unwise thing to do. In other words, I don't think you can make these guarantees that our society is already filled with them. And they don't help. They help a certain group, but at the expense of others very often. And you cannot be sure. I would not dare to tell you that you will make up in gold what you lose in paper dollars.
I got one question for you that put you on the spot here. Give me your, and I know these are guesses, but just for a hell of it here, what do you think gold's going to do here in the next some period of time? Tell me what kind of prediction you have in terms of your guess.
Free of charge.
from I think just to see I know you're talking about larger periods of time than anybody's personal investment thing would be, but you're talking about a year and a half or something like that until whatever your scenario is for this pending risk. I mean, if you're willing to predict a depression as bad as the one in 1929, you might as well take another shot at it. That's what it's been building.
Yes, I would not dare to do it. Well, I'd rather answer your question by telling you why I am very bullish on gold at the present time. See, the problem with the question is that gold doesn't go up in a straight line. You yourself have pointed that out. Like, gold is subject to the whims and vagaries of the marketplace like almost anything else. And it goes in fits and starts. And some of these fits and starts have been quite dramatic, as you know. All I am telling you today is that gold is generally going to go ahead in bigger steps than it falls back over the future, and especially the immediate future. And
well, you were talking about thousands of dollars.
Yes, but now let me tell you why I see that. Because the longer this paper money world goes on, with every central bank in it running its printing press, the more confidence in paper money is going to erode. So that's on the demand side, that's on my side, that's the basic bullish factor. Gold now is quoted on the radio and the newspapers and so on, about as much as the stock market is. Sometimes they pay more attention to gold than they do to the stock market. It's become a matter of concern to people all around the world. And on the supply side, the supply is shrinking dramatically. I mentioned before that a year ago when the U.S. was selling 1.5 million ounces a month, and the IMF 444,000 ounces, that was more gold than South Africa was producing each month. There was a lot of gold. And now the U.S. has stopped. And I will say that I'd be very surprised if the U.S. had another auction. The last auction was November 1st. So that 1.5 million, they took it out in two steps. They first went from 1.5 million to 750,000 ounces last April, and then they said, well, we're going to auction in surprise amounts at surprise times, and they had one surprise on November 1st, 1.25 million ounces, and then they haven't auctioned since, and Miller just said in the last week or 10 days that they wouldn't auction in this particular climate. So I think with all the war scare and all that, the U.S. has stopped auctioning. And the IMF auctions come to an end early May. They're only, there's one Wednesday this week, and then three more after that, and then that supply stops. Then the next biggest supplier is the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union produces, they think the Soviet produces about 300 tons or so. Maybe 350 tons a year. Nobody knows exactly how much they produce. We do know how much they sold. In 1978, they sold 410 tons. In 1979, the best figure I've seen is 300 tons. And in 1980, everybody expects them to sell less. So that supply is shrinking. In addition to that, gold mines all over the world are producing less gold at higher prices than more, because they have only so much equipment and facilities, and it pays them to mine lower grades, and they get less gold out of the lower grades. So the last year, for instance, in the United States, gold production fell 9%. So gold production is, the supply is falling, and the demand is growing. And that's why I'm confident that gold is going to go to thousands of dollars an ounce.
And that
you would be, you would do well. Of course, it would have been better if you had passed this bill a year ago when gold was $240 an ounce.
What about, you know, like South Africa produces, what, 80% of the gold in the world, something like that?
Yeah, about two-thirds.
Two-thirds, okay. But, you know, what about, right now they have a limited amount of tools that they can use, but over time, you know, that they'll be encouraged with this higher price to go to the lower grades and restart mines that have been shut down. Alaska's happening all over, so a lot of people going gold mining now because it's worth more. So that should increase the supply, or if they might even discover a new, you know, major vein.
If that happens, I would be the first to change my forecast.
You would buy some stock in it, though. For mine.
Look, now we're talking about individuals, yes.
You're almost disappointed me.
No. I have been, unlike a pension fund or a trust or something like that, I have not hesitated to tell private clients to go 100%. By that I mean gold and gold mining.
The bill, by the way, limits the percentage of 15% of the pension fund. Not more than 50%. I want to thank you very much for traveling up here. It was a very interesting testimony. Very interesting piece of legislation. Really enjoyed it. Thank you. No other questions. We need to adjourn.
You all know my views.
have to take an oath.
I was just going to say, isn't there a thing on swearing in?
This memorandum attempts to do essentially two things. First is to analyze the current situation with regard to the state loan programs and revenue bonding authority. These two questions are combined because revenue bonding is, along with direct appropriation for investment, the one of the three main methods of funding loan programs. The explanation of the current policy begins on page one and essentially describes a situation where the major volume lending program, primarily housing, the source of funds was shut off.
Why is that?
Primarily because of the introduction of a bill in Congress by Al Ohman that would remove housing issues from tax exempt bonding status. And he has had the effect by introducing the bill of having the bill passed, which slows down that quite a bit.
Could you go over this in terms of explaining the current system, the way housing loans, how the housing loan market is? Has been satisfied with this problem.
The housing market, as of the combination of Veterans and Alaska Housing Finance Corporation at the end of the last year, was financed almost entirely from the state's point of view and to a significant degree from the point of view of the bank by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, which is a quasi-independent entity that secures funds by issuing revenue bonds. Then it uses those funds to act as a secondary market. That is, a bank will make a loan, turn around, sell it, they HFC will hold the loan. Up until the time it was shut down, HFC was taking up a larger and larger part of that market. Without Alaska Housing Finance, the banks would have gone to correspondent banks or to any one of three or four different federal programs that would have bought them. But HFC was, in fact, the big mortgage lender in the state by providing that service. And as I said, the Al Ohman bill shut that down completely and left the state of Alaska with a situation in which there was not any funding available for housing.
Mike,
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, if I recall, go ahead, sit down.
As I recall, we had a deal where the state would say put up $5 million and the Alaska Housing Finance would leverage it into many, many millions. They did that with revenue bonds, but that's credit for revenue bonds. They needed the $5 million to begin with. Why?
The money was put in there were several funds, but the main one was the mortgage insurance fund, which was essentially an extra security for the bond buyer to look to in the case of default on loans, because AHFC wouldn't have a whole package together before they went to the market. What they do is they get a segment of it in loans, and they'd be able to show that to the buyer and say, these are the kinds of loans that secure these bonds. But since they wouldn't, they obviously wouldn't make all their loans because they needed the money first. What they would also do is have the legislature vote an appropriation to these mortgage insurance funds, or to that specific mortgage insurance fund, which would serve as a sort of a fallback in case a loan went bad, they'd buy it out.
Let me ask you about that mortgage insurance fund. We appropriate every year, is that correct? What happens to that money? Where is it?
It's invested by market securities. So
you know how much total is it appropriated over there?
That's not defined. I don't.
Somewhere in the back of my mind, I had a $3.32 million.
So it's pretty high. It does sound pretty high.
It's 50 to 1, and they have bonds outstanding of almost $600 million. So it's probably around $12
million.
Not $12 million.
I don't like complicated.
For the other loan programs that the state makes primarily through the Department let me ask one more question. Okay, so what you're saying is then that because Congress took away the tax exempt status of the bonds, and that we don't have that market, we don't have a place, that place to get money anymore.
That market does not exist right
no
now.
More.
Right.
So what we've got to do to continue the program, we've got to figure out another way to get money. Is that what it's like?
That's correct. Opinion is split as to whether or not that market's ever going to open up again.
Yeah. The thing important here is to keep in mind that the market's still there. The fact is, though, that the tax-free market's not there anymore. So if you sell the bonds, you're going to have to pay more interest on the money. You still borrow it, but not on a tax-exempt basis.
Right. You can go to the tax or the bond market, which is probably not as manipulable by Congress.
What kind of difference are we talking about in interest rates between what we had and what's available for us right now to go elsewhere?
Well, it fluctuates an awful lot, but I suppose somewhere in the range of 5 to 6 points would be a rough spread.
Currently, or the last AHSC bond sale was about 8.75%. State bond sale prior to that was 5.6. Much 3.
Well, that's the difference between the tax exempt market. The difference. The question was the difference between the tax exempt market and the taxable market. Yeah, because they both go like this a lot. But it's around 5 to 6%.
Another question. Revenue bonds, the bonds that us have in finance sold. What was the lack of bonds?
30-year bond, but 30-year bond, 30. Yeah, we matched with the length of the wall.
That's a good one.
The other loan programs, the state has a whole series, and they're listed in Milk's attachment to my memo here on the back, of revolving loan funds for various purposes. And as you'll be able to see just by looking down the columns, some of them have been much more active than others. But for some period of time, I'm not exactly sure how many years, these have not been funded by appropriation, but have rather been funded by the Commissioner of Revenue under authority granted to him in the statute governing the investment general fund surpluses. And in fact, for the program in the last year, which is the period that we're more or less discussing, they have been funded by a commitment from the Department of Revenue for $90 million. To purchase essentially $90 million worth of loans through the Department of Commerce, or through the Division of Business Loans in the Department of Commerce. Now, that $90 million, just as an example of a potential problem that I try to point out in the memorandum, is the Commissioner of Revenue's figure in the end. He's got the money. That is not the legislature's figure, because these are not funded through appropriation. In terms of a second somewhat related problem, it is a problem, is that in some of these revolving loan funds, if you'll notice, it had very little or no activity. Residential care facility revolving loan fund, it had not made any loan, and functioned under the assumption that the legislature was trying to tell the executive something by setting up the fund, but evidently didn't get the message to come out. The questions, the policy questions that I attempted to raise here, and this is not meant to be a comprehensive list for part three, that is, whether or not leveraging is the best way to go, that is, spending somebody else's money, how, if it is a policy goal, do you insulate the source of funds from the kinds of fluctuations we've seen lately in the tax exempt market, and how the legislature is able to get firmer control over the policy in terms of what types of loans are made by category and how much loan activity you have in each of these funds. Because the Commissioner of Revenue has essentially been financing them, and Department of Commerce has been making a lot of these loans, they, in effect, set the policy for these programs at this time.
Well, we have the power to do that, right? We just haven't done
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. We do have the power.
And we've delegated to them the authority in the interim to do things as the same.
Well, there's a derived authority under the general fund surplus. I'm not aware that there's been any specific direction year by year to the Commissioner of Revenue from the legislature to do this. He's got the authority. If the legislature doesn't appropriate, he's the only place they can get money. And that's the way it's worked out. That more or less describes the...
I wanted to ask a question about the residential care revolving loan fund. There's probably a couple others like it. Is it just that there haven't been any applications, or that how come it hasn't been used? Don't nobody wanted to use it, or the administration has decided against putting it into action, or legislature failed to fund it, or what's the situation?
Well, it's not that the legislature failed to fund it, because the legislature has, to that extent, failed to fund all these programs. They put a loan of money out. As to the specifics of that program, I don't have the slightest idea why they haven't been used.
Where did you get that information?
There's other programs like that, like the alternative technology and cars.
I can tell you about that.
Right. I show loans.
Not on residential care.
Child care facility.
Child care, but not residential.
Residential care.
But for example,
that was your deal about 5 years ago, right?
Yeah. I thought you meant you said child care.
For example, on the alternative technology, there, the Division of Business Loans is administering that program. Every one of their other loan programs is designed for businesses. This is the one loan program that they administer, which is designed for individuals. Up until 2 weeks ago, their loan application was a business loan application. And I know of several cases of individuals who went in and were scared off by the paperwork required of a business loan, which is not necessarily what you normally require of an individual. The department has adopted new forms, which were available 2 weeks ago. And all along, I know in the Fairbanks office, people have been discouraged by the person from Commerce in the Fairbanks office from applying for that loan fund. I don't know how it is in the other offices. But this creation of the fund doesn't appear to take care of the problem. Well, that's one of the funds that I think we have a big problem with. Because the department doesn't want to administer.
Well, we need to fund it.
If we earmark funds specifically for that, I'm sure we would get it. As it is now, they could access the same money that any of the other Division of Business Loans do, but apparently that's not how it works.
Mr. Chairman,
yeah.
When I look over in the back, I recall we have some types of loans where they do the paperwork and go down to the Department of Revenue and figure wherever they go and say here, they don't ask the banker whether it has any money to take care of it. Okay? And some of them we actually appropriate X number of dollars into a revolving loan fund and they lend it out and hopefully some of it comes back and they get free. Am I missing something? What I would like to know, I would like to look at, I'll grab one. Tourism Revolving Loan Fund. How much money has, what I need to know is how much money in the legislature has appropriated to this thing since it began, and if there's any of it left, you know, these types of things. Am I missing that on the page?
Well, I believe, and Milt actually heard this, but I believe that if you take the column loans held by fund, those are the actual components of the revolving loan fund in that principal and interest payments can go back to that fund and they can make more loans.
In other words, that's all the dough they had at the time this was written, that's what they had to work with?
Well, no. The next column, total loans outstanding, is the amount of money they've actually loaned out. And what you do is if you subtract column A from column B, the answer there would be about, what, 10 million?
$17
million is now being held in revenues.
portfolio. They've got $17 million worth of those ones that they bought out. I'm not aware that anybody else purchased loans from any of these funds except for the Department of Revenue. I don't think anybody would. So what you have is essentially is two sources of funding. One is appropriations for revolving loan funds when those were being done. And I don't know how long it's been since legislation went through. I have no idea when the last time they appropriated to say the revolving loan funds. But it's been some time. But you have that, and on the other hand, you have the buyout of the trader, which essentially cycles through.
I missed something. If you put $20 million in a revolving loan fund, mm-hmm. I always had the idea, and I never really looked into it, just never borrowed from my banker. But if I always had the thought in my mind that put $20 million in there so they start making loans out of it. And pretty soon they have all this good paper and people are paying interest and making payments and so forth. And when they made loans to the extent of $20 million, they're out of business. They didn't make any more loans because they didn't have any money. Are you telling me that when they make a loan and the paper's good, then they can take that down to Treasury and sell it?
Yes, sir.
Well, hell, that's kind of... but isn't that the kind of thing that is where we, all at once, we're making millions of dollars of loans, now once Treasury didn't have any money, so we don't have any loan program?
Yes, sir, that's about what happened.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's...
Mr. Chairman, in a memo that perhaps you could find from last year, Mike, that you wrote regards to fragmentation of policy making on loans, that was the word you used, was fragmented decision making. By that, I think you meant that we're not in control of it, and revenue is not in control of it. In some cases, the statute says that revenue must purchase. At least there used to be.
That was eliminated last session.
That was eliminated last session. But the last session, revenue had no choice on some of the loans. So you got commerce making some loans, you've got revolving loan funds making some loans, revenue purchasing them or making them themselves from, buying them from pension companies. You got about 15 different sources and really no control. And the legislature has thought in past years that somebody said, we'll go like $1 million into the revolving loan fund of tourism. We have had the impression, I've had it, that we're setting a limit of $1 million for the loans by doing that. We're not. We're just giving the prime and the pump with $1 million and they can use $1 million to and roll it over 10 times a year if they can get revenue to purchase it. So it's out of control. There's no doubt about that.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, on that point, basically what happened with the revolving loan funds in those areas where there's any degree of interest where people came in for loans, the fund didn't revolve. The amount of loans that were made were much greater than the amount of repayments of principal and interest in the revolving loan fund. In order to cure that, the legislature, in some cases, gave permission authority to purchase or direction to purchase loans from those funds on a priority basis. The result of that, of course, was that number one, the revolving funds were no longer dependent on the repayment of principal and interest to operate the program at all. And number two, that the end up with serious cash drain. Treasury. And number three, of course, is any legislative intent of setting the initial loan fund size meant nothing at all. Working from this, Mr. Chairman, what I've attempted to do is to lay out some not really specific options, but types of options or directions that the legislature might want to take to address this question. And there are four in the memo, and there is a fifth that I'll speak briefly to you. I didn't quite get into it. You have essentially.
Wait, before you things in that we, that your investigation here has shown from what the discussion has been here. One thing is that the old way of doing things, which is now defunct, but the old way of doing things, the decision making on how many loans the state was going to subsidize, underwrite, or facilitate in some way was made by a number of different entities.
That's correct.
And the legislature being one of those, but it wasn't even necessary for the legislature to take any action. Last year, for instance, we had bills before us, and we adjourned without taking any action. And yet, hundreds of millions, or at least, yeah, hundreds of millions,
hundreds of
dollars of state money decisions were made to put hundreds of millions of dollars of state money into loan programs or facilitate loans or underwrite loans, those kinds of things, without the legislature taking any specific action or giving any direction. So that, two points there. One is that the decision making was very fragmented, split up among a number of different parties. And secondly, that they could bypass the legislative process completely in terms of making a decision. Would you agree with that?
That's correct. I think that the sort of the rough number from that time to this $300 million spent contracted for or committed or whatever you might want to call it.
Now, in addition to that, what you're saying is that there's been a crisis. A crisis has precipitated out of a number of different factors, the Omen bill, state of the economy, whatever. But the old way, which was fragmented and bypassed the legislature, has broken down and is not functioning right now.
That's correct.
So that gives us the reason to try to look at the loan situation and do something about it. But since we also know that it's had these other problems, it's also a good excuse to remedy those problems while we're fixing the other one. Right? So in other words, what we might want to do, one option would be just replace the bond money with state money and not change any of the way the decisions are made. But that would still make it fragmented and bypassing legislative control. So what you're saying is that all these, not just you, but people have been saying, these things are going on and we need to look at it from that perspective, maybe take care of those two things. Do you see that or not?
Yeah. No, Mr. Chairman, I think you're right on the track. If today we're about to begin a discussion of the options, paper prepared by Mr. Dugan, I'd like to offer some comments on the issues that the committee might consider affect some of those options.
Yeah, thank you. This time.
I want to ask one question. Roughly, how many dollars of the state's money tied up in loan programs?
General fund money, about $840 million. General fund.
800? Yeah. Mr. Chairman, is that reflected on the last page of this?
Mike, I think you're counting HFC.
Excuse me. No, I double counted again. It's about, according to Bill's figures, $483 million that would be general fund money, an additional $52 million in revolving loan funds. And then if you start to add in the revenue bond money, in addition to that, what is the final code? Something over $1 billion.
That's your question.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, sort of to amplify on some of the issues Mr. Dugan has raised, I just kind of make a brief presentation to me. There's something that I've been thinking about also. I appreciate the opportunity to sit in and discuss. But I think Mike has kind of outlined the fragmented way of handling the loans in the past. In a lot of cases, revolving funds where they ran up against the limit in the fund, the limit that was appropriated to it, either in the general investment statute or another legislation, provision was made for commissioner, treasurer of revenue to purchase loans and revolving loan funds. As I said, that meant that you no longer had a revolving loan fund. You had basically an open door to the treasurer.